how many else of you in the room kind of serve this role in your family, but I am my family's designated technical support person whenever it comes to anything to do with iPads, iPhones, computers, or any of those kind of devices. Do I have any other tech support in the room? Come on now, it's Christmas week. This is our Super Bowl, right? I mean, it really is. You're going to have family in town. You're going to have somebody walking in, help me with my phone, help me with my iPad. I got to get this set up. How do I install this gift card? How do I do this and all these things? I mean, it's just kind of something that happens. And so it happens to me quite frequently. Now, my parents don't live here. Our family lives out in Missouri. And so it was a few months ago whenever mom and dad came into town. And literally the first thing that my dad said as he walked into the room was, good, now you can fix my iPad, you know? And so it's just kind of just because like my mom and dad, they've done this thing. I don't know what they've done. I don't know what it is, but somehow they have tied their Apple IDs together. And so now whenever you text dad, you actually are texting mom. And or if you're texting mom, you're texting dad, and you just don't even know what you're going to get. They're getting all the messages. And so they came in, and so I'm trying to be a good son and walk them through the technical support. It's like, all right, let's go to our settings. All right, so that's this button. Okay, no, so no, this button, click that button there. Settings, spelled S-E-T-T-I-N-G-S, click that. All right, now let's find our Apple account. We're going to find the Apple account, the iCloud account. That's what we're looking for. Click on that. I don't know what your password is. I don't know. I don't know what your email is, okay? Do you know what that is? Okay. All right, that's fine, you know? And I'm trying to walk through all these things and just trying to get it all straightened out. And then all of a sudden, there's this something that just kind of comes out of me that just goes, just give me the phone. All right, just give it to me. Move. Let me have it. And then I take about an hour and a half, and I finally get it all sorted out and where it needs to be. And in that moment, what I realized is that I wasn't just taking a phone. I was actually taking control, right? That's what I was doing. I was grabbing control there because in my mind, it felt more safe. It felt more efficient. I would be able to get things done a little bit quicker. And the problem is, though, is that whenever I took control, is I ceased to teach my parents how to actually fix the problem. And the other day I texted my mom and my dad replied. Okay, so it's all back where it needs to be. But you know, one of the things that control does is it kind of gives us this idea that it feels safe, it feels secure, it feels like we've got everything in our grip. But the only thing that control really does is while it promises, you know, things like safety, it can only deliver anxiety. Because the harder we try to control things, the more pressure begins to rise in us. And the more we try to control, the more we realize just how little control we actually have. Is that not the truth, right? And so whenever it comes to this time of year, there are a lot of things that end up spinning that we try to control that end up leading to a little bit of chaos and a little bit of frenzy in our lives, okay? It's not just family tech support. This is a busy time of year, is it not? I mean, there's so much going on, and I know a lot of y'all, you've already got your Christmas plans ready to go. Some of y'all, you're watching online today because you've already ducked out for your Christmas plans. But one of the things that is going on is that as the pressure of the holiday season just kind of begins to rise, then our desire for control just kind of rises with that as well. And this is why this time of year you can have some of the best fights, right? I mean, you really can in a marriage. I mean, it can get a little gnarly at times because, you know, we've all got our family traditions of like how we do things. And so it's like, hey, we know that Christmas Eve, we're going to go to a Christmas Eve service. And then we're going to go back at Christmas Eve night. We're going to go to my mom and dad's house. We'll celebrate Christmas there. We're going to wake up the next morning. We'll have our own little family Christmas there. And we'll open the presents. And then later that afternoon or into that evening, we'll go over to her parents and, you know, we'll have Christmas there as well. And that's just the way it always goes until one day your wife wakes up on December 22nd and said, hey, I was thinking we should go to Mom and Dad's for Christmas morning, and we should do that. And then all of a sudden, what happens in you is like all of your control just like starts just going crazy. Come on now, doesn't it? It just kind of starts going crazy. It's like, that's not how we do Christmas. We don't do Christmas like that. How is that? That's not how this works. And then your brain starts to just, it begins to just twist and begins to turn. It's like, if I do Christmas at her parents' house, then what are my parents going to think? They don't think that we don't love them as much. And so what are we going to do that? What about the kids? I mean, the kids are going to, they're going to be, that's just going to mess them all up. The kids wake up at 5:30 every single Christmas morning. You know, mom, her parents don't even wake up till 10. They're going to starve to death. They're going to be just driving us crazy. I've already bought all the eggs for the casserole. You know, what are we going to do in this? And so what we start to do then is we try to control the situation, don't we? And what we do, we start manipulating. And we start going through, this is so complicated, baby. This is so, I don't know about this. I don't know about that. You know, I already bought the eggs. Eggs are expensive. I mean, I guess we can just throw them away. You know, we can just do that. We can just throw the money away and just light them on fire. I mean, if you just want to do that, we can do that. Got a $20 bill. We can just light it on fire right now if you want to do that. You know, and you're just kind of like, you know, I was hoping that we were just going to have a nice, meaningful Christmas morning with just us and our kids. But if you want to do something different with your parents, then that's fine. You know, we can do that too. And then you end up just in a knockdown, drag-out fight, don't you? Come on now. Am I getting too close to home now? Come on. Now, we've all had this, right? And what happens is, like, it just starts this massive fight. And you didn't start off, like, you didn't wake up that morning going, you know what I want to do? I want to fight my wife about Christmas plans. You know, the happiest time of the year? Let's make it the biggest fight of the year. Let's do that. Nobody wakes up with that. All we're doing is we're just trying to maintain what? Control. This is how it's supposed to go. And the moment that control is challenged, the first casualties are always gratitude, joy, and hope. Those things just cease to exist from that point on. Why? Because the problem with control is it promises security, but the only thing it can deliver is anxiety. And so today, we're going to be in Matthew chapter 2 of the Christmas story. And in this, Matthew's going to tell, he's going to introduce us to three different groups of people, one person and two other groups of people. And what we're going to see is that whenever this newborn king that we are celebrating his birthday, you know, this time of year, whenever this newborn king arrives, there's actually three responses that people have to him. And they're very, very clear in this story, because this king's arrival, what it does is it's going to challenge every single one of us listening and reading this passage today. And it's just this. Here's the question it's going to hit us with. Am I going to continue to cling to control, or am I going to surrender to the newborn king? That's the question that is on the docket for today. So here's what we're going to do. Matthew chapter 2, if you got your Bible, let's get them open. If you don't have your phone, if you don't grab your phone, go to the app or your note sheet there. I'm going to read all 12 verses, just read this to you. And then we're going to walk through these three responses. This is what it says, starting in verse 1. It says, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? If you're in your notes, you might want to just like underline that little phrase, king of the Jews. It's a big phrase. We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. And when King Herod heard this, he was, say the word with me, he was what? Disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. In Bethlehem in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written, but you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. It's Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. So here we go. Here are three responses when the newborn king arrives. Here's the first response we see in Matthew chapter 2. It's this. It's a response of Herod, and we'll label his responses. This is what happens when control is threatened, right? Whenever Herod's control is threatened, this is his response. His control has now been threatened. Now, Herod, whenever we meet him here, he's aging, he's old. He is physically failing. Mentally, he is unstable, like massively unstable. He has become hyper paranoid. So he is off his rocker. I mean, he is not in a good place physically, emotionally, or mentally. Whenever he was younger, he really was quite the politician. I mean, if you go back and you read the stories of how Herod was able to navigate things between Mark Antony and other guys and all these things, I mean, the dude is amazing. He was an amazing politician. His nickname would have been Slick Herod or something like that because he was just so good. He should have been executed. He picked the wrong team, but it didn't matter. He made it through. I mean, just an amazing politician. And he was very, very politically skilled, but he was also ruthless. Now, if you're going to hold on to power for almost 40 years like Herod did in this dangerous, dangerous world, you're going to need some tools in your arsenal. Tools like fear and intimidation. Tools like violence and annihilation. Because that's what he did. I mean, like the dude's first act whenever he becomes king and they appoint him as king over Judea is he had the entire royal family that was alive before him just executed. Just line them all up, get rid of them because I don't need any perceived threats hanging around this place after this. I mean, it got to the point later in life, he was so wackadoodoo out that he thought his kids and his wife, one of his wives were trying to usurp the throne and overthrow him. So he's like, well, I'll just kill him. And so he did. He just killed his wife, killed his sons. I mean, just loony bin. He even killed his son's barber, okay, because he thought the barber was in on it, all right? So, I mean, the guy was just completely out of his mind. And the reason that he was so just fearful is Herod knew a really important fact about himself. He was an illegitimate king. He had no right to the throne. He wasn't from the line of David. He hadn't been handpicked by God to be the king of the Jewish people. He had been installed by the Roman government, a foreign government, to keep the peace because there had been too many uprisings of the Jewish people over the years in their captivity. And so they're like, Herod, your job is this. You keep them quiet. You keep them quiet, you get to keep the kingdom. You don't keep them quiet, we'll kill you. So he knew what his job was. Got to keep these people quiet. And so that's what he does. He is keeping peace with an iron fist. So whenever these magi show up and they say, hey, where is this baby that has been born king of the Jews? Immediately Herod's just like internal anxiety just flares up because this is not a good deal, right? Because here's the thing about kings. There can only be one king in a kingdom. You understand this, right? There is no such thing as co-kings. It doesn't work. And Herod knew that. And so if there's a new baby that has been born who's to be king of the Jews, then that means that this baby is a threat. And so that is why Matthew says he was greatly disturbed. He's freaking out is what is going on. But Matthew also tells us that it's not just Herod who is greatly disturbed. It's actually all Jerusalem with him that are greatly disturbed as well. Because here's the thing about Herod. The Jewish people knew this, is that whenever Herod gets disturbed, people tend to die. And if he is upset, that means we got to be upset. Because anytime that there is panic in the palace, there's going to be crisis in the streets. And so we got to be on our guard because his fear never stayed internal. Because what is going on for him is he's just going, oh my goodness, everything that I thought that I was supposed to be doing is now being threatened. And so this illusion of control that he has lived with for 40 years, that he's got it all under his grip, it is now falling apart. He believed that all he had to do is if he could just stay in control, then he would be safe. But the moment that Jesus shows up in the story, that illusion collapses. Because if God is actually the one in control, then Herod is not. And listen, Herod doesn't fear God, but he does fear a competitor. And so he is like, I can't have this. His control has been threatened. It's not leading him to peace. What does it actually lead him to? Well, look at it. It leads him to manipulation. He brings the scribes in. Hey, tell me a Bible story. Hey, real quick, I got a Bible question. Just tell me what's going on here. Not because he actually wants to know what the Bible has to say. He's doing intelligence gathering. He brings in the Magi. He's like, so when did that take place? Just so, you know, because I'm curious. Because I'd like to know what the age of kids it is that I need to murder. Okay? That's what is going on. It leads to deception. He's like, because I'm going to go and worship that baby, which is liar, liar, pants on fire kind of stuff, right? And then it leads to violence, which you know the story, as it just kind of goes along. As well, he ends up wiping out kids in that small little town, because when control is everything, then there is nothing that is off limits whenever your control is threatened. And so that's what's going on in Herod's heart. In fact, I would call it there's this like loop that is taking place in Herod. We'll call it the Herod loop. We'll put it up here on the screen. Here's kind of the Herod loop. So he's got this strong desire for control. And so as long as things feel like they're under his control, everything's good. But the moment that there is a threat that is introduced to his control, that's what causes the fear to rise up, which leads him to going, okay, now I got to manipulate the situation. So I'm going to manipulate the scribes, manipulate the Magi. I'm going to manipulate things by trying to wipe out any kid who could be this threat to the throne, which leads to chaos. And then you want to know what happens after chaos? Well, chaos convinces us that the problem wasn't that we were trying to control things. So what do? We try to control harder, which leads to threats, which leads to fear, manipulation, more control. That's why it's a loop. It just keeps going on and on and on, because the chaos doesn't cure our desire for control. It only intensifies it. And here's the thing about this loop, and I know this is true about me, and I think this is true about you. I have seen this in my life, and I'm sure you've seen it in yours. That you try to control, something threatens it, makes you scared, that puts you into manipulation mode, that leads to chaos, and it just keeps going and going and going. So the real question for you and for me is not, do I struggle trying to control things? The question is, how do I respond when my perceived control is threatened? That's the real question. In fact, really, if you wanted to just go up into the blimp and get 30,000 feet on it, the real question is this: who is really king in my life right now? That's the real question that is being asked in all of this. Who's the real king? Okay, we've got two kings in this story. You've got the baby king, and you got King Herod. Who is the real king? Who is the one who is really king in your life right now? And one of the biggest clues to understand who you think is really in charge is whenever things don't go your way and what comes out of you. That is a huge clue as to who you really believe is in control. Because that what starts all of those emotions, it's that desire for control. And here's the thing, you and I, we might not be executing rivals, but when control is threatened, those same instincts show up. And so what we end up doing is we manipulate conversations, we start to push for our own way, we strain relationships, we'll leave people on red because we don't think they're acting the way that we want them to act, and we're going to do all these things, trying to control things and manipulate it. We're trying to act like the king, but there can only be one king in the story. And the spoiler alert is this: it's not you, and it's not me. Who is really king in my life right now is the question we wrestle with. So the first response is Herod's, and it's this threat and control. Here's the second response we see in here. It's the response of the scribes. And here's how we'll label the scribes' response. We'll call it they were informed but unmoved. Informed but unmoved. Now, there's only a brief mention. There's just a couple of mentions of them here. But I think we should pay attention to them, because Herod asks him, brings him in, hey, where's this king supposed to be born? And you notice here, it doesn't say that they broke off for discussion. They didn't debate it. They didn't do anything like that. They just immediately give the answer. It's like, oh, the king, the baby, he's supposed to be born in Bethlehem. How do you know that? Well, Micah 5, verse 2 and 4, that's where he's supposed to be born. Supposed to be born in Bethlehem. Oh, okay, so do we know when he's supposed to be born? Well, according to Daniel and his prophecies, yeah, we got a pretty good idea. He should be born about right now. And that's kind of what the conversation is like. And here are these scribes, these scholars. They know the answers. They know the Bible. They know all these things. They know that, you know, here we're in the time. We're in the area to when the baby should be showing up. And it, whenever these magi show up to Jerusalem and to Herod, and they say, hey, we think the king has been born, the scribes don't move. They just stay there. They know the answer. They know it all. But whenever they hear, yeah, the king may have been born, they're just like, eh. Here's what blows my mind. Bethlehem is 5 miles from them. It's an hour and a half to 2 hour walk for them. And you've got these guys, who we'll see in just a second, have come 1,000 miles from the east saying, hey, we think the king has been born. And these scholars who for all their lives have been studying, parsing, you know, sentences, diagramming sentences and doing all the things with all the things in the Old Testament, they're like, yeah, we know where he should be and all these other kind of things. They're just like, yeah, that's great. Nothing. Isn't that amazing? Why do those scribes, why do they just stay put? I mean, is it that they've just become so familiar with the scriptures, or, you know, have the promises just become so familiar that they've lost their power? And sure, maybe it could be that, but I actually think it goes deeper than that. I think the reason why they don't make the 5 mile journey to go see the greatest miracle in the history of humankind is because God had become a concept to them, no longer a person. God had become somebody that they could explain, but they did not experience anymore. And it was something that they, and since they could explain it, that means that they could put their arms around it and they could wrap them, they could put them in this little box, and it meant that they had a kingdom that they were in charge of, and so they are just absolutely comfortable with where they are, and they don't want to be disrupted. Because a distant God keeps me in control. But when a king arrives, that demands surrender. And why would I drive 5 miles so that I've got to surrender to a new king? It challenged their authority. It challenged their comfort. It challenges their control. And for me, as I read through this, just honestly, it is really scary to me to read through this and go, man, they were 5 miles away from this incredible miracle and they just missed it because they didn't want to be disrupted or bothered. And man, I just think, and I'm talking to us church people right now, those of us who are church people, this should make the hair on the back of our neck stand up, man. I'm talking to those of you who were born in the baptistry, your first meal was communion, you've done flannel graphs, you've done color sheets, you've taught VBS, you've volunteered and done Sunday school, you know the stories, you know the songs, you know who Father Abraham is, you got all the things, you know the motions, you know the song, you know all of those things. This should make the hair on the back of your neck stand up, because it means that you can know your Bible better than anybody else, you can have correct doctrine, and you can know all the truth and still be somebody who is spiritually unmoved. You can get to the place, I can get to the place, to where we are familiar with the things of God, but faith becomes something that we explain and we don't experience. That's where the scribes are, isn't it? They got all the knowledge, but they've divorce the knowledge from the experience, and it's led them to apathy. And as you read the story of Jesus and it goes along, their apathy is actually going to be hardened into opposition, isn't it? They're going to be the ones saying, that dude's got to die. You got to get rid of him. We don't need him. We don't want him. That's where they end up. And friends, I think that there is a great warning from the scribes here. And the warning is just this, and listen, if you're church people, here's the church people question. Has Jesus become somebody I can explain, but he's not someone I follow? That's the question. And so I think the diagnostic question for this, whenever we're kind of working through this, is here's the filter I would work through things, okay? It's just this. God, where have I stopped expecting you to move? Because that's where the scribes are. They have always lived in a someday kind of world. Someday the king's going to come. Someday the Messiah's going to show up. And whenever today shows up, they're like, we'll stay in the library. We don't need to go to Bethlehem. We'll just stay here. Because they've stopped expecting God to move. And so for me, the question is, and for you, it's like, where have I stopped expecting God to move? For some of y'all, it gets really personal. It's like some of y'all, you've given up hope that God can move in your marriage. You've given up hope that God can move in your finances or move in your relationship with your kids or with your grandkids. You've stopped hoping that God can move or expecting God to move whenever it comes to your calling and where he's leading you and what he wants you to do with your life. We've stopped expecting him to move. Some of y'all, it says you stopped expecting God to move whenever you walk into this place on a Sunday morning and you're just like, well, just another Sunday morning. Sing a few songs, listen to a guy talk for a little bit, then we'll go home. But there's no expectancy of going, man, God, show up. Would you do something? Holy Spirit, if you're moving through this area, don't skip us by, right? We want to experience you. We don't want to just explain you. We want to experience the move of God in this place and in our hearts, personally, corporately, all of us in our homes and in our families. Where have we stopped expecting God to move? And if you are able to pinpoint it, and go, man, I know exactly where I've stopped expecting him to move. Then here would be my tack on prayer. And it's just this: God, give me expectancy. I want that expectancy back. I want to wake up every single day expecting that you're going to do something in my life. Give that back to me. So if Herod, it's about his control being threatened. The scribes, it's their control is preserving their comfort. They don't want to be disturbed. Well, then we've got one last group of people to look at. They are the Magi. And what we're going to see about them is that their response is that they were willing to surrender. They're willing to surrender to the king. Now, let's get a few things out right quick because, you know, there's that one song, We Three Kings, that just kind of messes all this stuff up. Nativity scenes mess all this up. First off, we don't know that there were only three, okay? We don't know that. There could have been 333. We don't know, all right? We just know there were three gifts. They weren't kings. We do know that. They're not kings, so that wasn't what they were. We're not exactly sure where they came from. Probably Persia, Babylon, but we're not 100% for sure that's where they came from. They weren't astrologers who were writing horoscopes and predicting things like that. What we know is that they were outsiders. They weren't from the Jewish faith. They didn't grow up with the scriptures. They don't have religious credentials. Now, if they were from Persia, Babylon, those are areas to where the Jewish people were in exile for hundreds of years. So there might have been some things that were still floating around there, but it's not like they were people who were the scholars like the scribes. And what matters about this group of people is this: they were willing to seek, and they were willing to move, and then they were willing to worship. In fact, one of the things I love that Matthew's doing here is like there's almost like this contrast here that's going on between you've got Herod and the scribes and the Magi, and what he's helping us see is like, man, you've got Herod and the scribes, they're like right there. Like, they have proximity running out their ears whenever it comes to being close to the things of what God is doing. But these guys are the farthest away from God, literally almost 1,000 miles away. And so what Matthew is helping to see is that sometimes the people who are farthest from God are the ones who are the most responsive to the king. They have less authority than Herod. They have less information than the scribes. And they have more faith than both of them combined. All they had, look at it, verse 9, was a star and a promise, right? That's it. Just like the entire Christmas story. Nobody's been given the entire plan. It's just like, here's what you get. You get a star and a promise. Just follow that star. Okay, I'll follow the star. And that's what they did. And so they just go. And whenever they get there, it says that they rejoiced with exceedingly great joy. They were overjoyed. They were losing their minds, just like they had opened up a Nintendo 64 in 1996, right? It's just this, losing their minds. Why? Because they found the king. They found the king. And they're able to surrender to that king. And whenever you surrender to the king, that replaces your need to control everything. Because whenever you truly find the king, you get to go, this is amazing. I don't have to be in charge anymore. I get to relax and I get to surrender to him. And that's what leads to the worship. They bow down and they give their gifts. They open their treasures and they laid down what they valued the most so that they could acknowledge who mattered the most. And so here's the diagnostic for us as we're just working through this. It's this. So what am I holding on to that Jesus is asking me to place at his feet? So that's what the Magi do. They find him. They're moved. They move into worship. And their worship leads them to lay down at the feet of Jesus gold, frankincense, and myrrh. It was costly. It was visible. It was an investment. Surrender, my friends, is always going to cost you something. Sometimes it's something tangible. I mean, it could be gold, it could be silver. Sometimes it's going to be your control. Sometimes it's going to be your comfort. Sometimes it's going to be your self-protection. It's going to be all kinds of things. But the question that we wrestle with is like, what is the one thing that I'm afraid to release and lay at his feet? Because that could be the thing that is keeping you back from experiencing the overjoyedness in the same way that the Magi did. Remember, surrender will never cost you more than your control already has. So lay it at his feet. So your bottom line this morning is this, is that control breeds fear, but surrender sparks freedom. That's the way to true freedom, is whenever we loosen our grip and say, I am not a very good king. There's another king in the story, and it's not me. And we loosen up our grip. We surrender that, and it sparks some freedom. So my challenge to you this week is just to name one area where you're clinging to control. And then just pray, Jesus, I trust you with this. What is it that you're trying to control? Some of y'all, you've walked in here, you're white-knuckling things, man. You're trying to control your kids. You can't control your kids. Come on now. You're trying to control your spouse. You can't control them. You're trying to control your parents. I mean, good luck with that. What are you trying to control? You're trying to control outcomes. You're trying to control all these kind of things. You're trying to control your future. You can't control it. So why not just say to the king, I trust you with this. You're a far better king than I am. Because what Herod knew is still true. There can only be one king in the story. There is no such thing as co-kings. And so surrender to him and say, Jesus, I want you to be king of my life. And so maybe you've never done that, and today's the day you want to do that for the very first time. Or maybe you've been a follower, you've been walking with Jesus, but today you're just kind of realizing, you know what, I'm clinging to some things a little tighter than I should. Well, as we sing this song here in a moment, our prayer partners will be up here at the front, and they would love to pray with you and to talk with you about what the Lord is doing in your life. Help you to pray that prayer of surrender, Jesus, I trust you. This is the best moment to, just like the Magi, to be moved to surrender. So that you'll be moved to worship. So, Father, today we are asking that you would loosen our grip. And help us to see that whenever all these anxieties and fears are sprouting up, it's probably because we're trying to control things that we were never intended to control. And so, Lord, help us to loosen our grip, surrender to you, lay it at your feet. Give you all of our worship today, and we pray this in your wonderful name.